testimony on House Bill 5021, which is the budget bill for the Department of Higher Education. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 5021. And let me talk about a little bit of ground rules. We have a large number of people that are signed up to testify today. Some of those people are invited testimony, and I will be taking those folks first. What I would ask you to do in the interest of giving everyone the opportunity to testify, because we only have a couple of hours to do this, is to hold your testimony to 3 minutes. And what I'll do is, when you're about 2.5 minutes into your time, I'll give you a signal. So if you could avoid having me stand up and wave my arms in the air to get you to notice that signal, I would very much appreciate it. And with that, we will begin invited testimony by having a panel of students, Mike Fries, Danielle Cox, and Amira Marino, come forward. And after they're finished, I'll call forward Bart Lewis and Michelle Gertz. So if the students could come forward. Good morning.
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 I can imagine that you're all quite nervous and quite outside of your comfort zone, so please just take a deep breath and come and just tell us what you want us to know.
All right, thank you. Chair Morgan, members of the committee, I would like to thank you for allowing me to testify today. For the record, my name is Mike Fries. I'm a junior at Eastern Oregon University, and I am studying Environmental Economic Policy and Management, or EEPM, as I will refer to it throughout the testimony. There are several reasons why I decided to attend Eastern Oregon University. I wanted to find a school that had a major specific to my interests, that was affordable, and had small class sizes, and was close to home. Growing up in Eastern Oregon nearly all my life, I wanted to continue education in a similar region. EOU offered majors in my areas of interest and was closer to family and friends than any other state institution. It was important for me to remain close to my family as my brother grew up and as my grandparents got ill. Affordability also played a large role in determining which school I attended. At the time of acceptance, EOU was the most affordable institution in the OUS system. My parents make enough money where I can't receive low interest loans from the government or government grants, but they do not make enough money where they can pay for my tuition or my brother's, who also attends an OUS school. Tuition is paid out of my own pocket from money earned over the summer months or from part-time jobs held during school. If tuition continues to increase, I will be forced to take loans and become indebted in an economy where the job market is currently poor. The small class sizes of EOU have proven to be most benefit for students from rural Eastern Oregon. Eastern offers great opportunities of involvement throughout the university because of its small class size. Personal relationships with professors is encouraged and instituted with a degree of enthusiasm. Having these relationships with teaching faculty and ever available one-on-one assistance is a great indication of the quality of education that is offered at Eastern. My major, Environmental and Economic Policy and Management, is offered at Eastern Oregon through Oregon State University Extension Services. Although my major is important for the community that I live in, there are few students involved in this program. It is only through the Extension Services program at Eastern that the program exists. This could mean with further cuts to the university system that my program could be at risk. This degree is important in our agricultural-based area because it offers additional studies for those who are interested in work daily with the environmental policies. I have the opportunity to study environmental economics, something that has become very important to my surrounding community. Without increased state support, it is likely that either tuition increases or loss of my program could end my experience at the OUS school. Tuition increases, like the tuition surcharge, has made higher education much tougher to afford. The tuition surcharge was unforeseen when budgeting for the year and proved to be detrimental to many students at Eastern. State support is very important for Eastern to remain a high-quality, affordable institution that we can all appreciate. I encourage the committee to maintain state support for higher education and help students like myself finish school without a financial burden. Regional schools are asking for your help to keep quality and affordability in higher education and keep it at the top of your list. Thank you.
Oh, right on the money.
He's a professional.
Thank you very much. That was a very good testimony. Ms. Cox.
Good morning. Chair Morgan and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Danielle Cox. I'm a senior at Oregon State University majoring in political science. I've had the pleasure of attending Oregon State for 3 years, and I'm looking forward to a fourth. I'm here to support the Oregon University System budget. Okay. I grew up in Molina, Oregon, a small town outside of Oregon City. When looking for which college I wanted to attend, my background played a major part in my final decision. I first looked out of state at the University of Arizona and the University of San Diego, but when I visited their campuses, they did not fit what I was looking for in a school. I wanted to go to school in an environment where people understood my background and were serious about getting a degree, and I did not feel that either of the schools would allow me to reach my goals. So I returned to Oregon and attended a community college by deciding between the University of Oregon and Oregon State. I chose Oregon State in the end because I felt that the community and the campus aligned better with my rural background. I was confident that I could get a great education at either institution, but felt more comfortable at Oregon State, and it was really important that the community was there so I could make a smooth transition.
Danielle, would you pull the microphone a little closer?
Sorry.
Yes, we're stopped talking about Oregon State.
Please proceed.
From my family to college. Oregon State is the only land-grant university and has many unique programs for students. The extension services provided critical outreach to many different areas in the state and help bridge the rural-urban divide that many people in Oregon talk about. I'm a political science major, and I'm looking to get a second undergrad degree in business. Oregon State provides me the opportunity to study while living in a community where I feel comfortable and is close to home. When I graduate, I'm not sure what I want to do with my degrees, but I am confident that I want to stay in Oregon and give back to my community. I am a member of the Tri Delta sorority at Oregon State, an experience that is very important to me. One of the great things about being a member of a sorority is that the people you meet and the experiences you have. My sorority sisters come from many different backgrounds. These women are engineering majors, agricultural majors, business majors, science majors, and the list goes on. They come from Portland, Glendale, North Bend, Mitchell, Lakeview, and Corvallis, and many other parts of the state. The great thing about OSU is that it provides access for students from so many different backgrounds who are interested in a wide variety of topics. I know that Oregon State is just one of the universities in the Oregon University System, and that each university provides students with unique services and opportunities. I may not know what I want to do when I graduate, but I know that because of Oregon State, the doors will be open for me. It is important that we continue to fund universities at a level where they can continue to provide diverse programs to serve a diverse population of students. My university experience has shaped much of who I am today, and I hope that the state can continue to allow as many students who want to achieve a degree from OSU or any other school such an opportunity, no matter their background. Thank you for your time.
Excuse me, Madam Chair. This was a constituent of mine. Thank you very much. Are you a Republican by any chance?
Representatives.
I'm seriously considering a bill to close down Oregon State.
Oh, now. Okay.
Mr. Marino, please proceed.
Good morning. Actually, Amara is unable to attend today. She has to work this morning. My name is Kelvin Nicholson. I'm coming in her place. I currently go to Polton State University. I'm a junior right now, and I'm majoring in management and IS. And actually, my major really played a part in why I decided to go to Polton State University. Simply, large town surrounded by people of the business community. It sounded like an amazing opportunity for me. So that was the primary reason why I decided to go to PSU. However, I'll be honest, I was going to transfer after 2 years. However, after seeing immediately many things about PSU, is I decided to stay for all 4 years. For instance, I learned that it has an amazing business school, one of the top 10 in the nation by some standards. I've also learned that it has extremely innovative teachers. Teachers who are actually interested in teaching, not going and boosting their ego through like power dynamics at some schools, MSM teachers, and not through doing such things as doing solely research, but actually concentrating on teaching us students. And lastly, as I learned, that there is an extreme diverse culture at Polton State University. I have friends, close friends of all different races, all different sexualities, all different political stances, all people with different experiences, which of course helps me understand how humans function better. However, let's talk about what's really at issue here, budget cuts. Okay? There are many obvious problems with cuts that could happen. For instance, there are going to be less classes. As administrators need to find ways to save money, this is going to be one of the first options. But going hand-in-hand with this is there's going to be less faculty, and this includes maintenance staff. So what's going to happen? There's going to be less teachers teaching less classes in buildings that are being maintained by less people. And, of course, this all comes down to the student. There's going to be higher tuition for these students. And, of course, because of higher tuition, it's going to hurt access. And, lastly, there's going to be larger classes. I've already witnessed it. My class last term was merged with another class and then gained to 35 to 40 people in a class designed for 25 people. Of course, and this hinders the one-on-one access with the teachers. But there are less obvious problems. For instance, teachers right now are already some of the most poorly funded in the nation. Also, going hand in hand with this is that teachers right now have little, if no, job security. And what this means is that there's going to be inherently poor teaching. Teachers are going to be worrying more now about how they're going to fund their families, how they're going to take care of their families, and also about whether or not they're going to have their contract renewed than actually on teaching. They're going to look for more secure jobs. I know this firsthand. My mother's a teacher at Southern Oregon University, and although she is adored by her students, she most likely will be finding a new job in the near future simply because it does not have any job security and there is not enough funding. 80% of Portland State University students are Oregon residents. 80% of 23,000 PSU students are true Oregonians. 18,500 Oregonians. So what does cutting higher education do? It hurts Oregonians. It hurts them in the short run and is detrimental to them in the long run. As teachers leave, classes get larger, and the satisfaction with higher education is diminished, the value of being an Oregon decreases. I know. I was born in Ashland, Oregon, February 15th, 1983, actually living for 14 years next to Senator Lynn Hannon. Myself
you
as
and
an
I are not here to take abuse.
Oh, Representative Bates.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Jeez. Didn't even notice that.
He's got the hammer.
Yeah, there we go. Myself as an Oregonian, thank you. I see education as the epitome of opening doors. However, by cutting higher education and any education in general, all we are doing is sealing these doors closed. So, I thank you for your time this morning and urge you to think about what is important to Oregonians in the short run, but also, more importantly, in the long run. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We really appreciate you coming here, and you're very articulate young people. So, thank you very much. I will call Bart Lewis and Michelle Gertz forward, and after that panel, I will call Harvey Matthews, Jim Craven, and Gordon Hanna. Mr. Lewis, good morning.
Hello.
Please proceed.
Okay, my name is Bart Lewis. I'm a clerk in the Business Affairs Office at the University of Oregon. And thank you for the opportunity to share some of our thoughts, those of us that are classified staff, thoughts we have about the budget and where we're going. In the building next to mine, the science building, science complex, in the chemistry labs a few years ago, they had four science lab preparators, people that set up the lab materials, supervise the labs. Now, within a couple years, they're down to three people because of budget cuts. These people work in a lab that has dangerous materials. They work with students, many of whom are in labs for the first time. They're now to a point where if someone is sick, one of the lab preparators, that person often has to come in when ill just to cover a shift. They don't have the flexibility to help each other. They work bad or irregular shifts as a result, and at times they've had to employ students to help them, students who should really be supervised in this kind of work are often going unsupervised. In another department, the library, a decade ago, they had about 135 classified staff. Now they're down to a little under 95. It's about a 30% reduction. At a time when there's more and more demand for library services, with a larger student enrollment and an information explosion over the last decade. Where I work in the business office in student billing, and I started there 26 years ago, we had two people working the counter, two people working the phones, and one person who did some of both. Today, in 2003, we have exactly the same staff, two on the counter, two on the phones, and one backup. On the other hand, we went from 16,000 students in 1977 to over 20,000 in 2003. And the complexity of the work we have has increased. We do so much more in the way of billing than we did then. It's not just tuition and mandatory fees now. Many students, depending on the department they major in, have to pay, if you're in, say, business or journalism, an extra $125 a term. If you're in one of the sciences, you pay an arts and sciences resource fee of $40 plus a $20 science fee each term. If you're in the dormitories and you want to get out of your dorm contract, we now require you to pay $9 a day for every day left in the term of your contract. This is a cost borne by the students and parents. I've seen dorm contract fines go over $1,500. And these are the kind of services we have to provide, both billing and, needless to say, in explaining to students and parents why we're doing this. And the explanations we give and the way we handle it really reflects on the kind of an institution that we are. Also, some people have said, well, with computers, you should have really less work to do. In actuality, the computer age has increased the kind of services that we're able to provide for our customers. Email itself now, people, we get so many emails, far more than we used to get handwritten letters. People expect tax information. So with all of this, we're desperately concerned that any further cuts in the services we provide will reflect on our people. And from a personal note, some days it's hard to even have time to tell a student to smile at them and let them know that everything's going to be okay, that we have a staff that's qualified to help them and give us the time to do that. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Gertz.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Michelle Gertz. I'm Vice President and Director of Intellectual Property for CH2M Hill Limited. I'm based in our Portland, Oregon office. I'm here to talk today, about recommendations developed by the Engineering and Technology Industry Council, better known as ETIC. And I'm here to add my perspective both as representative of my firm and also as Vice Chair of ETIC. ETIC was chartered by the legislature in 1997 to advise the university system on engineering education. The voting members of ETIC are executives from Oregon firms, both high-tech and other firms that rely on engineering and technical skills for their business success in this state. We work closely with deans and other leaders in Oregon educational institutions. As a business leader in Oregon, CH2M Hill views ETIC's mission as important for three primary reasons, and I refer to the handout which you have of PowerPoint slides. Slide number one. The approach used by ETIC is the same as what we use in industry, from the first step of identifying opportunities to holding those responsible parties accountable for results. Secondly, this approach is working, and how do we know this? We have a firm, working industry-academic partnership. We also have found that people on the committee are really committed to producing results. The public investment is being leveraged with growing private support, more than $1.60 for every $1 of public money provided. These measurable goals that ETIC has identified are kept in focus, and ETIC is on the path to achieve these goals. Third and finally, ETIC's results are critically important to the stability and growth of Oregon's economy. How do ETIC's results relate to Oregon's economy? Third slide depicts this. The products and services that drive Oregon's economy relate to markets, state, country, and world. innovation, efficiency, and quality are essential to get these products and services to the entire market successfully. And these three attributes are provided by highly educated professionals, including engineers and technical specialists, whose Oregon companies must hire in order to be successful. So slide four, there's this direct effect both in growing existing businesses, creating and attracting new businesses and industries, bringing money into the state, and growing the economy, and hence tax revenues. And there's a sustainable benefit because these then go back to building the skilled workforce, including engineers in the state, the quality of that workforce. In case you doubt that there's a kind of a relationship, if you look at slide five, we have data that relate the number of computer science and engineering degrees to the per capita income growth in 50 states in the U.S. CH2M Hill, slide 6, is an example of the kind of success that ETIC can bring. It was founded in 1946 in Oregon by a professor at Oregon State and three graduate students who recognized a growing market requiring innovation in wastewater management. Now we have more than 11,000 employee owners, 160 offices around the globe, a $2 billion company. Our success continues to be based on our ability to innovate on behalf of our clients. We choose to have more than 10% of our staff resources in Oregon, largely because of our close and successful alliances with all Oregon higher education institutions and the innovation that this affords us. So ETIC's success is equivalent to our client's success and CH2M Hill's success as a professional service firm. On what is ETIC success based? 2 points, slide 7, access and excellence. Access, doubling the number of engineering graduates between 1999 and 2009, providing opportunities to Oregonians. Excellence, dramatically increasing the national rankings of our programs, departments, and colleges, increasing the readiness of graduates. Slide 8, from these goals, we've derived specific parameters, which are listed in slide 8, and we monitor these. These are what we keep the focus on, our eye on the ball. Slide 9, ETIC thus recommends actions to build on the success of the program that's been demonstrated to date. Access and excellence work together, hiring faculty, enhancing lab and other facilities, course content improvements, expand and increase the quality of engineering programs. They increase our ability to recruit and retain our best students in Oregon. Enhancing pre-college programs leads to more interested and able students in the state of Oregon. And it's an investment in diversity, an example scholarship program that Oregon Industries have developed under the umbrella of ETIC has found 30% of the participants being women and 30% being underrepresented minorities. So overall, our recommendations lead to more leverage for your public investment, faculty, students, quality facilities, and industry working together to create greater opportunities and probability of generating grants and other revenues. So in summary, over the past 6 years, ETIC investment approach has proven to be one of the best investments that Oregon has made. To continue Oregon's success record with ETIC, we recommend a public investment of $40 million over the next 2 years, which private industry will match with over $67 million in private funding. This funding continues the key approaches of the program, proven successful, will help grow Oregon's economy both directly and through ensuring sustainable continued future growth. Thank you for your attention. I'd be willing to answer questions if you have any.
Thank you very much. Chair calls now Harvey Matthews, Jim Craven, and Gordon Hanna. And on deck is Dale Buck on behalf of the Extension Service. And following him will be a panel of four 4-H students, Laura Simmons, Delora Brumfield, Lupe Flores, and Viviana Gomez. Well, there's no one out there that looks like Harvey Matthews.
This is Harvey here.
Pink rabbit again.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jim Craven representing the American Electronics Association. I send Mr. Matthews regrets. He was called away to Portland this morning. I'm not sure why, but he did want to let you know that he would have liked to have been here. So, on behalf of AOI. Very quickly, and I appreciate the chance to testify, and I know you have a very busy schedule today. I guess I'm the business association representative for the whole building, so there's a lot of weight on my shoulders. But I just do want to say that on behalf of not just the high-tech industry in Oregon, but I think I can speak for the business community in general, we're here to support a tremendous success story. And that's the basic bottom line. I joined AEA in 1988, and I guess I would say that in those earlier years when I represented this industry, I would say that higher ed was somewhat fragmented. I think it was somewhat distant from business, and I think it was perhaps lacking in clear goals and accountability. But if you fast forward to 2003, I think there's just been a tremendous transformation that I have seen and been glad to be a part of. I think the higher ed institutions today are close to the business community. I think they are integrated in addressing key goals of the economy. And I think accountability is probably at an all-time high. We all know, and you've heard for 2 weeks now, about the importance of higher education in helping Oregon businesses succeed, both in terms of research and in terms of undergraduate preparation and graduate students. I think a few years ago you heard, even sometimes maybe from us, that the message in higher ed was, you know, we're not as good as other people and we need to improve. I think that has changed today. Instead of talking about inferiority, I think it's changed to, you know, we are very good and we want to move forward to being the best. And I think that's a better message. And I think that's why the business community has started to invest as heavily as it has in this enterprise, is that people invest in winners. People don't invest in, hey, you know, we're not very good, give us some money and maybe we'll get mediocre. I think the message with higher ed and the business community in Oregon today is we are very good. And we want to be great. And I think that's the message that turns around the support from the business community to saying these are institutions worthy of support. Leave you with just three quick thoughts. One, I certainly want to echo the testimony of Ms. Gertz on behalf of the engineering and technology improvements. But I also want to say that we shouldn't make choices in our higher ed investments with the business community. This is not a message of engineering instead of statewide public services, or engineering instead of agriculture, or engineering instead of the Forest Research Lab. We think all of those entities are serving the general business community in Oregon and all need your support. And I just want to close with hopefully at some point you will get on to Senate Bill 437, which is the Higher Ed Efficiency Act that has come out of committee and been subsequently referred to Ways and Means. We think the set of tools that are embedded in that bill will help provide some flexibility to higher ed, particularly in these tough times, to be a little more entrepreneurial, to save some dollars, because we realize that there aren't going to be big infusions of new money into higher ed, and we ought to help them with some tools to use the money they have wisely and more efficiently. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Hanna.
Thank you. My name is Gordon Hanna, and I'm a member of the Board of Directors of the University of Oregon Alumni Association and the chair of its Advocacy Committee. I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk a little bit about the budget. I wish I could be here today asking for a whole lot more money for the U of O and for higher ed in general, because I'm a big believer both in higher ed and the fact that it has been inadequately funded for a number of years in the state of Oregon. But I know that more funding for higher ed this year is just not in the cards. We recognize that the budget is at the state has been badly impacted by the economy and also by decisions that the voters have made in the past, kind of coming home to roost. So higher ed is, like all education, very much a value of Oregon. I know as I grew up in Springfield, it was my parents' view that their children needed to get an education, and that included a college education. And there are parents all over this state who want their children to have better opportunities than they had, and they're not going to have that opportunity without a system of higher education that's open and accessible. Funding is part of that. I guess as I sit here today, having achieved whatever modest success I have in life, I attribute a lot of it to the education that I obtained at the University of Oregon. And I wonder if I were faced today with the hurdles that stand between a graduating high school senior and the opportunity for a higher education, I'd be here. When I graduated from high school, I got a part-time job working at a Weyerhaeuser plywood mill in Springfield. between my, when I graduated in 1975, I went back one last summer and worked before I started law school. I graduated from law school, and within a year after I graduated, everyone that I worked with in that plywood mill was out of a job because that mill was nothing but bare walls inside. I had an opportunity to go on and remain productive, and the other people there who did not have higher education did not. And that's really the difference and the value of higher education in Oregon. Like I said, I know we probably can't increase our funding, so I want to echo Mr. Craven's comments about Senate Bill 437. I know as you work through the budget, you'll begin to recognize the benefits of providing additional flexibility to higher ed, flexibility to allow each of the institutions to sort of seek their own niche. I know that at the University of Oregon, we want to provide the highest quality education. It may not be the cheapest, but it will be high quality. There may be other institutions who choose another path, and one of the great things about Senate Bill 437 is it allows that. It allows some flexibility. So on behalf of the University of Oregon and the Alumni Association, which represent about 60,000 ducks across the state of Oregon, I hope you will support the efficiency measures contained in Senate Bill 437. And following your work on this bill, I trust that you'll your budget here, I'm sure you'll recognize the needs for the flexibility in that bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Chair calls Dale Butt, and after him, a panel of 4-H students, Laura Simmons, Delora Brumfield, Lupi Flores, and Viviana Gomez. Good morning, Mr. Buck.
Good morning, Representative Morgan, Chair, and committee members. I gave the staff kind of a thick packet up there, and I will just...
For the record, could you identify...
My name is Dale Buck, and I live at 25590 Chinook Street, Cloverdale, Oregon, which, as my letter says, is just outside Beaver, Oregon.
Thank you.
My wife and I have sold our dairy farm in Tillamook. And so since I still have a 20-year mortgage I'm holding, I'm vitally interested in keeping the dairy business going. And there's not much anybody in this room can tell you people that you don't already know about higher education or the extension service. And I just want to talk a little bit about the extension in Tillamook County, and that's what I've given you. Is a 2001 report that was put together by our extension agents that I like to call my extension agents because I think very highly of all of them. And then I just put a letter together that begins with the part in this report that each of those agents has put in there. So if you just, when you got a minute sometimes, I think you can kind of quickly run through it and see what went on in Tillamook County in 2001. A lot of things were accomplished during that time. And it's not easy to put a dollar value on how well kids wash their hands or how they what they eat for their diet, but I think we all understand that there is a dollar value to it when we look at health things. And those are things that Nancy Kirchhoff and Assistant Donna Nelson do. Agent Joy Jones works with those traditional 4-H clubs and Master Gardeners program, and I've listed there the tree plantings and things that her clubs have accomplished. And my wife asked me last night where it says 1,600 willow cuttings, trees, and posts. She says, what's posts? Well, we bury willow posts in the riverbanks, and they catch gravel, and they grow, and it's a way to sort of get them faster going. John Fodskar is an extension agent who works up and down the coast with the shellfish industry, and in 1999, Tillamook County's shellfish industry was worth $291,865. It's rather small, but it's important. Tillamook County Creamery Association in 2001 had a net sales of $240,750,000, and I want you to understand that there's a part of that that is non-dairy products. We own a feed mill or part of it. We have two feed stores, and we have a large retail a section at Tillamook Cheese that sells other than dairy products. And then I put in here that the milk price in Oregon, the milk value in Oregon in 2001 was $266 million. I put those in there to show you the value of dairy and the work that Troy Downing, our staff chair and dairy agent, does in Tillamook and Clatsop counties. He's an expert on forages, soil fertility, nutrient cycling, and livestock, and his knowledge is used outside of Tillamook County. And then Beth Lambert, our watershed management extension agent who works Tillamook and Clatsop County, does a tremendous job with watersheds, and since we are still involved with the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Trout, the work that she does is of value, I think. And I'll let you put a value on that. But and then since 85% of our land is forest land, we have an extension forester stationed in Clatsop County who works Clatsop and Tillamook County with small woodlot owners. And then in Tillamook County, today we have 220 4-H club leaders. We have another 90 master gardeners who donate time advising people on their gardening and other aspects around their home. We have about 1,000 children in 4-H clubs, 500 of those in traditional 4-H clubs, about 100 in after-school science and watershed-type classes, 400 involved in nutritional-type programs at schools that have more than the normal low-income families involved. So I think you can see that extension it's important, and this will give you some picture of how it fits in Tillamook County, and your counties will have similar stories to tell. And by this, I don't want to diminish at all the importance of the Ag Experiment Stations or the Forest Research Lab, because all of those are important to all of us. And I personally have followed the 0105 budget in its making. I've followed you folks as you've dealt with those special sessions. And I'm well aware of what you need to do to come up with another budget. I'm well aware of that. And I know it's not easy. And I commend you for taking on that job. But whatever money you can give us in OSU Extension, we will use it to the best of our ability to keep these programs going in our counties and keep our young people busy. And the thing that's not in this letter, but I said it in this building before, if you can give us what it costs to keep 2 or 2.5 young people in jail, we can take that money, hire an extension agent, and they will then find some volunteers, and you won't have those people to deal with in a court system, in a jail system, and they will be constructive citizens. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you coming all the way here today to testify before us, too. Chair calls Lara Simmons, Delora Brumfield, Lupi Flores, and Viviana Gomez. And following them, we will have Kent Madison and Ken Bailey.
You mean?
Good morning, ladies, and thank you for joining us here today. Delora, I've been seeing you on a fairly regular basis of late, but it's a pleasure to see you again. I'm sure you have this thought out, so I would just let you proceed with how you have it organized.
Chair Morgan and members of the board, my name is Lara Simmons. I am from Astoria, Clatsop County, and this would be my third year in 4-H. I am currently a junior leader in Wolf Track Archery Club. Even though kids are learning, 4-H is not something that kids have to do. It's something that they want to do. The 4-H program gives kids the opportunity to learn and become responsible members of their community. Through my 4-H archery club, I have learned to care about the safety and well-being of others, to be more aware of what is happening around me, and I know that with the 4-H program, I have learned more respect and responsibility and have become more active in my community. 4-H has helped kids achieve their goals. These same kids are returning to the 4-H as leaders to help the next generation of kids achieve their goals too. Without 4-H, we would just be an individual and less of a community. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today.
Thank you.
Chair Morgan and members of the committee, my name is Delora Brumfield. I'm a junior from Myrtle Creek, Oregon, which is in the southern half of this state. I have been involved in 4-H for 7 years and have been a member of the Riddle Nickel Livestock Club. Currently, I am enrolled in many leadership projects and am one of the current leaders for the Dairy Goat Project in Douglas County. 4-H has been the biggest part of my life for the last 7 years. It has allowed me the opportunity to stretch my legs and find out who I am and what I want in life, which is to work in an agriculturally related field or possibly in politics. 4-H has also given me...
and I bet she's a Republican.
Thanks, guys. 4-H has also given me life to my leadership abilities and brought forth those skills to allow me to help to mentor other kids and to bring forth the things in me and the things that other kids need to learn, such as public speaking, being able to talk in front of groups like this without messing up too terribly badly, and to just be there and be patient and be active community members. 4-H has also given me the skills to work in my project area. My project area with the goats is not very well liked because goats are seen as inferior and not worth anything. So therefore, it is hard to get information about them, and it is hard for any kid to start in that program because no one wants to help them, and no one has the knowledge to help them. So through 4-H, I've been able to gain the experience to lead other kids and the skills to help them with their projects so we can get more interest in that project and so everyone can participate. I'm also working now at the national level with 4-H, with the Youth Directions Council, and we're pushing to get more youth on boards and with adults so that youth can get their voice out there. And without 4-H giving me these opportunities to be able to get out there and to voice my opinions and to help be the person I am and be the leader that I wish to be, I couldn't do this. And no kid could ever get more out of this program than, I mean, this is just the most awesome program I've ever been in and I've ever seen. And I've been in various other programs such as Girl Scouts and the FFA, and I can tell you from personal experience, this is the best program for youth today. And while we do realize that some cuts must be made to everything, we are urging you not to make as strong of a cut to our program because you will devastate our program. And right now we are serving thousands of kids in the state. And on the national level, we are serving 6.8 million 4-H members. So please don't cut Oregon out of that. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Viviana Gomes, and I'm representing Oregon State Extension and the 4-H program. I'm 17 years old, and I live in Sandy, Oregon, which is in Clackamas County. And I have been in 4-H for 8 years. I'm currently a 4-H state ambassador, and I'm a team leader of my 4-H group. My family lives within 3 miles of town, Sandy, Oregon. We have 15 acres of land, mostly trees and fields. It's not really what you'd consider a farm, but a lot of people think that 4-H is simply cows and plows, and probably because I raise and show beef, and that's what they think of me. But the popular belief that 4-H only encompasses animals and agriculture fields is entirely incorrect. If 4-H was limited to only crops and livestock, we wouldn't have recently celebrated 100 years of an awesome program. Even though 4-H does have livestock and crop projects, there's also many other things like home ec. There's a computer program, speaking, woodworking, photography. The opportunities in 4-H and projects are endless. If I went off and named every project there is in 4-H, we would be here for hours. Charged by memories of his own 4-H experience in Sweetgrass County, artist Steve Oystedt says, "Boys and girls learning together with their head, heart, hands, and health remain constant over time in rural as well as urban areas of America. Projects and opportunities have changed. Kids, the 4-H, and American pledges have not. As an Oregon State Ambassador and 8-year member, I know what great things can come out of this program. 4-H is a great investment because a few funded agents can train volunteers who in turn teach the 79,000 4-H members in Oregon alone, who then gain leadership skills by assisting other members and teaching them throughout their 4-H experience. I have had experiences and leadership opportunities I would have never learned in school. 4-H teaches members essential life skills for their future, like teamwork, leadership, communication, and citizenship, to just name a few. This organization has been a key factor in my decision to attend vet school, and I hope to go to Oregon State University if the funds don't go up way too high. And I'm interested in this occupation because of my 4-H projects. If I hadn't done livestock projects or speaking or any other projects, I wouldn't be the person that I am today. 4-H is truly the organization that has made me and 7 million other 4-H members across our country who we are today. Thank you very much. Do you have any questions?
Okay. Members of the committee, my name is Lupe Flores. I'm a senior at Hillsborough High School in Washington County. I have been in 4-H World Wizards for 4 years. I am here today to ask for continued strong funding for the 4-H and OSU Extension Service Program. Before I started 4-H with Wizards, I was very discouraged and thinking about dropping out of high school. A counselor told me that Latinos did not graduate or go to college. A month later, I was introduced to 4-H, in which everything changed. My Intel Latino network mentors and 4-H staff encouraged me to continue in high school and convinced me that I could go to college. They believed in me. In 4-H, I learned that giving back to my community is a pleasure. I learned to fight for what I want and for my future, to make good choices, setting goals, and problem solving. I now have a different way of looking at life. I have received a congressional award for my community service, helped launch a new national initiative called Cyber Senior Cyber Teens, where I help to teach senior citizens how to use the computer and presented a workshop about my 4-H community service project at a national conference in New Orleans. I will be the first one in my family to graduate from high school and the first one to go to college. I look forward to college and to getting a bachelor's degree in computer science and counseling. Without the strong support Extension and 4-H has had in the past, many of these educational opportunities would not have been possible for me or the thousands of other 4-Hers in the state of Oregon, like me. Thank you for your funding you have provided to the Extension and 4-H programs, and thank you for allowing me to speak today.
Thank you all very much. Your presentation speaks well for your public speaking and leadership training in 4-H. So.
Yes,
thank you again.
Again. Senator Leslie.
Representative Bates.
Before you leave, I was very impressed by all of you, especially you, Lupe. You're the first in your family to graduate from high school.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going on to college.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you again. Next, I'd like to call on Kent Madison and Ken Bailey.
Morning, Senator Measurely Committee. My name is Ken Bailey. I'm Vice President of Orchard View Farms in the Dalles. I'm here today representing myself and the Wasco County Fruit and Produce League and Hood River Grower Shipper Association. I'm testifying today in favor of the proposed budgets of the Oregon State University Experiment Station and Extension Service. The Mid-Columbia tree fruit industry consists of 25,000 acres of orchards and 410 growers. More importantly, the industry employs over 3,000 full-time equivalents in agriculture and employs over 7,500 seasonal workers. It contributes $100 million of personal dollars to the economy and $200 million in the state economy. The OSU Experiment Station and Extension Service develops and provides the crucial horticultural information needed by the growers. The tree fruit industry plays an integral part in the state of Oregon's mission to strengthen the critical economic development programs of Oregon. Due in part to the closures of lumber mills and aluminum plants, Hood River and Wasco counties have some of the highest unemployment rates in Oregon, and the continuing viability and development of the tree fruit industry is extremely important for the health of our communities. Annually, with industry funds totaling over $400,000, the Mid-Columbia Area Research and Extension Center carries out 25 research projects. For sweet cherries alone, the research findings have benefited the Mid-Columbia region by over $1.5 million per year in net cash receipts. For pears, there's one project that has the potential to save growers up to $600,000 per year in cost. The sweet cherry industry of Oregon has changed radically in the last few years, due in great part to the declining processing industry and to the recent availability of new varieties for fresh fruit production and new rootstocks. The new focus of the industry is to increase production of high-quality fresh fruit for the domestic and export markets. To remain competitive, the industry needs to implement production practices that are not only horticulturally effective but cost-effective. Growers have been increasingly aware of the importance of orchard management practices that help conserve natural resources. There are economic benefits to this philosophy in reducing input costs, and domestic and international customers increasingly are demanding high-quality fruit produced using methods that help conserve biological resources. Thus, a major goal of the Mid-Columbia Area Research and Extension Center research program is to test and develop cost-effective production practices with an emphasis on conserving natural resources. Based on the results of these efforts, cherry growers in the Dalles have been investing over $2.5 million per year planting and maintaining new high-value orchards. The work done by the OSU Experiment Station and Extension Service play a critical role in giving growers the confidence to make this investment. I very much encourage you to maintain these programs as close to current levels as possible. Thank you.
Thank you. Sir?
Senators and representatives, we appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today. I'm Kent Madison of Madison Farms out of Hermiston, Oregon area. I'm a third-generation farmer. I, too, was in 4-H when I was young, and I, too, was a graduate of Oregon State University. And sorry about that, Representative.
That's all right.
Yeah, there we go. And as I continued on in my career in agriculture, I can remember the Hermiston Experiment Station being known just as that. It was the Hermiston Experiment Station to us local people, and that's truly what it did. It was an experiment area where they could do experiments on 50 to 100 foot square foot plots, and then we would take that research out and use it on hundreds to thousands of acres to determine and develop new strategies. I'm also the chairman. I'm speaking to you today actually as the chairman of the Hermiston Agricultural Experiment Station of the Citizens Advisory Group. The relatively new irrigated farm region in north central Oregon's Columbia Basin is among the most productive in the world. It's about a 33-to-1 ratio. So for every acre of production in the Columbia Basin, it would take 33 acres of that same kind of production in a third world country. So it's an extremely productive area of our state. The irrigated and dryland farms of Umatilla and Morrow County produce more food grown in Oregon than any other of the regions combined. Prior to 1985, very little research was conducted by Oregon State University to support food production on the highly productive irrigated soils of the region. During the early 1980s, members of the Blue Mountain Potato Growers Association decided that the old Umatilla branch station of Oregon State University should be restructured and appropriate scientists added to the facility to provide essential support. The commitment to maintain a strong station remains today. Not only the station supports the well-being of the farms in the region, but because the Columbia Basin has become one of the most important food producing regions in the nation. This has shown that for every dollar of tax money that is put into that station runs on about $1 million budget, it returns about a $37 million return to the lower Columbia Basin area. So in a sense, from a tax standpoint, for every dollar of tax we put into it, it creates $2.96 worth of taxes back to the state, assuming 8% tax rate. The staff
at the Hermiston Station also generates an additional $1 million worth of funds through grant funds from industry. So you can see that industry supports that research station extremely strong because it realizes the value of good, sound science through college-based research. The actions of the Blue Mountain Potato Grower Group encouraged OSU's annual experiment station to form an advisory committee for the station. Members of the original group and other station supporters were invited to be members of this branch station's advisory committee. One of the first actions of the advisory committee was to separate administration of the station from that of the dryland wheat stations at Pendleton and to assist in selecting a new superintendent. The second was to rename the station the Hermiston Agricultural Research and Extension Center. It was a whole lot easier to remember as the experiment station, but they changed the name. Although a series of continuing actions and advisory committees worked to create balanced facilities of scientists and an adequate budget to support research on regional farming technologies, the end result was a facility that the following agricultural professions, a crop scientist, a horticulturalist, an entomologist, a plant pathologist, and a soil scientist, and recently a riparian scientist, to assist in the salmon recovery. The committee's expectation was that each of these scientists would cover both research and extension through OSU assigned, though OSU assigned 4 to research and 2 to extension. Not only did the advisory committee procure budget and facilities through legislative efforts, it also raised considerable money to fund facility improvements and purchase research and extension equipment. Through these efforts, the station was converted from an antiquated animal research station to a modern agricultural research facility, equipped to develop solutions to production problems of current crops in the region and to diversify crops, thus making farming more profitable. Efforts of our agricultural industry raised funds to equip potato processing facilities in excess of $20,000, a horticultural quality lab in excess of $30,000, and a plant diagnostics laboratory in excess of $90,000, and a refurbished irrigation system, including 4 and soon to be 5 new center pivot irrigation systems in excess of $120,000. So you can also see that the local people and the local processors believe strongly in that station, and we fund a lot of it ourselves, because we realize that the research that comes out of that station ultimately benefits us as growers and producers in the area. Actions that the advisory committee and the regional agricultural industry have taken, including legislative action to fund research and extension, provided more than $6 million to improvements and operations of this facility. Further, members cooperate annually in research of the station by providing land on their farms for research projects. On our own farm itself, this year we have over 50 acres and 3 projects with researchers on our farm to actually apply that technology that they experimented with last year on a larger scale to see if it actually works in the field. Members of the advisory committee give freely of their time to assist the center and the university and are committed to maintaining a quality university and a quality branch station with healthy research and extension components. These are essential to maintaining a prosperous economy in the region. Our support at the Oregon Legislature has been critical in maintaining the strong budgets of both the Agricultural Experiment Station and the Extension Service. The Advisory Committee took critical action and created substantially increased research facilities to assist the Oregon Plan in salmonella recovery. The current downturn in the economy, however, threatens the efforts we have made. It has the potential to destroy the balance of scientific disciplines and to degrade the funding support of the remaining scientists. Dr. Gary Reed, the superintendent and entomologist, is retiring. The advisory committee recommends that a permanent superintendent be selected from the remaining faculty. We understand that filling the entomology position is not affordable at this time, but expect that when budgets recover, the entomology position be one of the first that the Agricultural Experiment Station refills. We are fully aware that your guys have got an undaunting task of trying to balance the budget. We have that same problem in our own farm budgets. On good years, you tend to spend money, and on bad years, you wonder where you can save money at. And so we're willing to say at our Hermiston Station that even though that entomology position is retiring, we'll agree to go without it for an interim period of time while the budget hopefully recovers and while the state's economy recovers.
Sir, are you about ready to wind up?
Just about, yes. There is no way that we can accept the reduction of extension facilities. I'll just wind up by basically saying that the economic engine of Oregon is what has to be revived, and I realize that that's a tough task, but the experiment and extension service statewide provides a huge thrust into that economic engine, so anything you can do to continue to keep that facilities operating will continue to allow us to continue to be profitable and in turn return dollars to the state. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Next, I'd like to call Martin Grobel and Bart Starker. Morning.
Senator Mesley, members of the committee, I'm Bart Starker. I'm I'm executive vice president of a fourth generation family business called Starker Forests in Corvallis, Oregon. We're also about to have three more fourth generation graduates of the forestry program at Oregon State University. So we're proud of that. I wanted to talk to you a little bit this morning about the importance of the Forest Research Lab at Oregon State University. As you're probably all aware, the Northwest is a high-cost region from a world market standpoint in forest products because of our wage rates and because of our regulatory climate and so forth that we're also very proud of, but it does put us at a certain disadvantage to other regions around the world. So we've got to compete on something other than cost. That means we have to compete on knowledge, expertise, and efficiency. And the research lab helps us do that in many, many ways. The other thing that Oregon has to be awfully proud of is our forest practices laws. And we're the envy of the other states around us, and that's because of the expertise and the involvement of the researchers at Oregon State University that have made that act tied to the science and tied to practices that will be both efficient and yet protective of our natural environment. I wanted to just mention really quickly a specific research plot that's been on our land for the last 40 years. It's called the Level of Growing Stock Plots, and it's a thinning study that deals with the density of trees and how that can produce both wood products and other values from our forests. And it's been, like I said, it's been there for 40 years, and it's been a subject of both many, many papers, but also extension trips and so forth that will get the word out to very many other kinds of owners that can look at those plots and decide how those plots fit into their management of their land and will provide the values they want from their properties. We've got lots of benefits from having research done on our land. We sometimes wonder whether we have any land left to really practice forestry on after we do our research. And that's a really symbiotic relationship we have with OSU and the Forest Research Lab. We get to see the research as it's being done, and we don't have to wait for the papers to come out.
Sure, you have about 10 seconds.
Okay. Just one last statement. The general funds that you all provide to the Forest Research Lab are leveraged about six times through other sources with federal, private, and grant sources that really make it really drive the engine of the Forest Research Lab. Thank you.
Thank you. Sir?
Good morning, Senator Messerly, members of the committee. My name is Martin Goebel. I am the president of a nonprofit organization based in Portland called Sustainable Northwest. I am a graduate of the Oregon higher education system, in this case Oregon State University and its College of Forestry. When I left Oregon State University, I went off and went around the world to practice forestry, and now I'm back giving back to this state in ways that I hope all the young people that we heard earlier today will do too. I'm here on behalf of the Forest Research Lab to tell you a little bit about what I see and what we see as the value of the Forest Research Lab to the broader community of Oregon. Sustainable Northwest, my organization, serves rural Oregon primarily, but in serving rural Oregon also serves urban Oregon. We work very hard to bridge the divide between the two through market approaches, education, and advocacy for sustainability. And that, I think, will be the hallmark of this state in the future. The Forest Research Lab and the College of Forestry, in which it is embedded, provide us at Sustainable Northwest and all the rural community projects that we're involved with a variety of different values and products and services. One of them is the research and knowledge they generate on sustainable forestry and restoration forestry, something that is becoming increasingly important to our state as fire risk and other kinds of issues beset our forests. Another one is how to use and value and add value to and market small diameter products, which are essential to be thinned from our forest into the future. The third is, of course, students. The students we saw here today are the kinds of students Oregon State's College of Forestry produces, and I would like to just say that if I could, I'd hire all of them today, as eloquent as they've all been. The Forest School, the Forestry School, and the funds generated by the Forest Research Lab hire attract about 70% to 80% of rural students to the college. It's a very important number to keep in mind. And finally, extension forestry really provides a lot of the bridging and the conduit through which knowledge is transferred to practitioners on the ground. As my colleague, Mr. Starker, pointed out, the amount of leverage that the Forest Research Laboratory produces in terms of the monies you appropriate to it is 1 to 5 or 6. You'll be hard-pressed to find a better leverage ratio than that almost anywhere in the world, I think. Finally, the revitalization of our economy in Oregon depends enormously on this idea of generating knowledge, generating human capacity and leadership, and the Forest Research Laboratory does that in spades. Finally, I would just advocate that you, as you apply your knowledge and your wisdom to the budget, that you apply it in equitable ways so that the Forest Research Laboratory is not adversely affected any more than other programs. Thank you very much.
Thank you both very much. What I'm going to do next is go to the people who have signed up who live over 100 miles away. First of all, Mario Herta, and I probably murdered that name. Also, Scott Pugred, I probably murdered that name. And let's see, I've got one more here, John Saylor. Could all three of you please come up? Okay. Go ahead, sir.
Good morning. Sometimes my English is not very good, so if you have a question, ask me, please. My name is Mario Huerta. I'm on the board of Oregon State at Cascade Campus. I'm director of Programa de Ayuda. Programa de Ayuda is a Hispanic Latino program in Deschutes, Crook, and Jefferson County. I'm here as a community member just to talk a little bit about the impact of the campus in Central Oregon. Before OSU arrived to the region, I'm working with students every day in schools, in high schools, and we help them to deal with different problems. And one of the problems is the things we help them is to encourage them to go to college. And before OSU Cascade, was very sad to see students just to drop out of the school because they didn't have options to go. It's very hard to go out of the region and pay for all the expenses, tuition, a place to stay, food. But with the OSU now, a lot of the students who never thought of going to college are working very hard. And I'm talking about students of all ages. OSU Cascade Campus has been the key to open a lot of doors for those students. I'm here just to ask you for your support because a lot of students in Central and Western Oregon are the dreams they have to go to college depending of the campus, and I believe that we are in very hard times. But more than ever, we have to think in the short term and long term. And OSU Cascade is going to be the key to help the economic to achieve the goals of economic growth for the central and a western area in Oregon. Thank you very much. Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much. Sergius, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Pugard, and I'm a junior at Eastern Oregon University. I'm a political science major and the state affairs executive for the Associated Students of Eastern Oregon University. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak with you all this morning. I wanted to start by saying that I've really enjoyed my time at Eastern. The campus, the administrators, and faculty provide an excellent education in an atmosphere that is conducive to learning. With special attention paid to each student and their education. But unfortunately, not everyone has the financial resources to attend Eastern. A lack of financial resources is the number one reason that students are not able to attain a post-secondary degree. Tuition has been a major topic of the budget hearing for these last 2 weeks. As a student representative, I want to weigh in on this conversation. This past winter and spring, Eastern students saw 24% tuition increase, which equaled to about $200 a term. We estimated that 60 students were priced out of an education because of this tuition surcharge. In a school of our size, the likeliness was good that a student who sat next to you in class had to drop out because of these tuition increases. With tuition on the rise, the impact on students is real, and unless the state steps in, we will be losing more and more students, not only at Eastern, but throughout our system. The Oregon University system makes the case that tuition is not the only factor in affordability, and I agree with them. Affordability is a combination of tuition and aid. In Oregon, we have high tuition and low aid, a combination our state should not strive for. As we move forward in this legislative session, it is unlikely that the state is going to be able to make a strong financial commitment to need-based aid. We just don't have the money. Oregon has already has high tuition and a lack of aid to match. So for the sake of trying to keep the doors of access open during these difficult budget times, it is essential that the state does all it can to keep tuition low. The Oregon University system has a set of peer universities that it compares itself to, which I'm sure that you've heard quite a bit about. I provided some information from the last OUS board meeting in terms of Oregon peer institutions and tuition. Oregon tuition compared to our peer universities puts us in the middle of the pack. But, as the OUS has said, tuition is not the whole picture. If tuition and aid is compared, Oregon is in a different position in terms of our peer universities. Oregon received an F in affordability in the Measure and Up report released in 2000 by the National Center for Public Policy and Higher Education. The only two other states that are peer institutions and have higher tuition than Oregon universities received an F in affordability, New York and New Hampshire, and New York provides more need-based aid than Oregon. Every other institution that has higher tuition than one of the Oregon institutions is in a state that requires a lower percentage of family income to attend college, a lower reliance on loans, or has a stronger student aid program, and in many cases are better in all three categories. There are only two states that provide less need-based aid than Oregon, New Hampshire and Missouri, but Missouri is a low percentage of family income is needed to attend college. So in reality, the only state that Oregon should be compared to in terms of affordability is New Hampshire, and we're competing for the bottom slot. Tuition proposals brought forward by the university systems are too high. There's a set of students that will never begin college because of the tuition increases, and a set of students that will have to drop out. The impacts of increased tuition on students is real. When students are working two jobs just to try to get through, it is hard to take on a third. I urge you to consider tuition proposals carefully and to look at them in the context of affordability. I also ask you that you fund the university system at the level where it can minimize tuition increases and maintain quality. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Chair calls John Saylor, Wendy Kroger, and Gary Scarberry. And next up is Chris Prawl, Greg Magnus, and Rachel Pilliot. Please proceed.
Yes, my name is John Saylor. I'm an employee, classified staff at Oregon Institute of Technology in Klamath Falls, Oregon. And I'm also a member of the bargaining team. Originally, when I started back in 88 at OIT, we had approximately 18 grounds maintenance workers there. Now, about 15 years later, there's a total of 15 employees at the same facility. That is the entire department, not just that one section of it. That's including managers and the rest of the staff. I'm part of a two-person team of workers, of maintenance workers. We take care of all the air handling systems on the entire campus for heating, ventilation, air conditioning systems. We are also self-supportive on drinking water. All of our potable water comes out of wells, just like our geothermal waters that heat the entire campus. Myself with my partner, Scott, we both care a lot about our positions and our jobs, and we do try to minimize as much as we can on costs and things of that nature. We also have a consistent daily routine of checking the water and also the air quality in the campus. We really kind of pride ourselves on the quality that we provide for our campus and the community inside the campus. We service approximately 5,000 people with just a team of two providing this high-efficiency service that we bring them. We ask that the budget does not get cut in these areas. We have many problems at the campus to where we address them as on an emergency basis instead of previously where we were able to address these as a preventative maintenance basis. It has gone from having the workload in a small department of 18 people to having now a workload of 4. All these areas have been cut, and what I ask is how much can we cut out of our university systems? I am also a victim of a previous program that has been cut in the early 90s. My degree was cut, and I had no focus for college. At that point in time, I went out into the job market. I worked private sector, and now I'm back in public sector. And the workloads are more overwhelming in the public sector than it was in the private sector. There was not as much need in the private sector to be able to, anytime we needed tools, we had them there. In the private sector, we have to prioritize what we get and what we order and what we ask for. There's a huge indifference, and I ask that we don't not only cut the funding, we don't cut the programs. This is a necessity for our young people.
30 seconds.
Okay. And this is also a necessity to keep the campus and the communities running. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Ms. Kroger.
Good morning. My name is Wendy Kroger, and I live in Salem, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of Oregon State University Extension Services and its 03-05 budget. First of all, I consider it a great honor to be able to spend time with the students that I've already seen here. There's no way that I can be as articulate and as persuasive as they, but I will say that I am a duck. I did grow up in Parkdale, Oregon, where I did participate in 4-H, which helped me formulate many of the values that I try to live by today. As a volunteer in my community, I have the pleasure both of serving as a master gardener, and I've also worked with the Watershed Stewardship Program. Today I represent the Marion County Master Gardeners Association. OSU Extension extends research-based information and learning to Oregonians in a time-tested and efficient way. Marion County Master Gardeners support community demonstration gardens, children's and school programs. We participate in garden clinics where we provide research-based information. And for those of you who wonder, posies do jump the fence. And so on occasion, it's pretty important that we keep some of those lovely exotics that we purchase at garden centers out of our farms and forests. Many of us have been recertified so that we can continue to provide information to the public. Watershed stewards fan out across the community. They provide restoration projects. They provide information and work with students to learn more about how Oregon, the beautiful Oregon that we live in, works. I left my work boots at home. I cleaned up for the act, but I can assure you that they're pretty muddy and pretty well used. Volunteers all. Without the professional guidance and leadership of OSU Extension agents, the entire program would be sorely diminished. Our service capability suffers if we don't have the Extension leadership to assure that we impart the most current research-based information to the public. This current budget proposal cuts programs, projects, and services across the board. It kills some programs and it hurts all the rest. Even so, we are here to support it today. We understand that the legislature has an incredibly difficult task in terms of balancing the budget, but given the level of reductions already taken in the 01-03 biennium, and given that funding was never anywhere near what the community needed even prior to that, we ask that you please fund extension and higher education at least at the level of the governor's proposed budget. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Scarberry.
Yes, my name
Could you pull a microphone over to you there?
My name is Gary Scarberry, and I'm here to express support for House Bill 5021. I also am a member of the Marion County Master Gardener Program. I live in Staten. One of the jobs I do for the program is I keep track of all the hours expended by the over 120 volunteers we have in Marion County alone. Some of these, some of the activities that are done by the volunteers are, first, one of the largest is what we call desk duty. Here's where the volunteers actually sit at the desk and answer telephones for gardening questions by the public and take care of those people actually coming into the office bringing in problems for consideration. Also, there's public functions that we get involved with, the how-to garden fair, help clinics at community fairs, children and schools programs, and speaking functions at community activities. Another area for volunteer is the Marion Garden, where the garden demonstrates effective environmentally safe gardening practices. It's also an excellent classroom for the 4-H World of Works program and the Juveniles Department Alternative Program. These hours are all spent under the direction of the Community Horticulturist for Marion Polk Counties, which is also the OSU Extension Agent. Since I started keeping records in 2001, Marion County Master Gardeners have volunteered over 15,000 hours. Last year, because of new programs being initiated by the present horticulturists, 9,000 hours were given by volunteers last year. That relates to over 4 full-time equivalent positions for the county. Obviously, the time budget cost for the community horticulturists is a bargain for the county considering these volunteer hours, especially when you balance this with the fact that he spends equal time with Polk County and the volunteer hours expended by people there need to be considered in conjunction with the hours I just expressed for Marion. The community horticulturist is needed and required for the direction and supervision of the Master Gardener Program for the benefit of the people here in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Chair calls Chris Prawl, Greg Magnus, and Rachel Pilliod. And next up will be John Brosi, David Johnson, and Jeff Seeger.
That's funny.
I suspect that you also have your presentation order figured out, so I'll just let you go ahead and proceed.
All right. Good morning, Chair Morgan and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chris Prawl, and I'm a sophomore in the College of Engineering at Oregon State University, currently studying civil engineering. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I really appreciate it. As you have heard, Oregon State University is a unique university, which provides critical services to the state through extension services and also provides education in areas that no other campus can provide. The campus, the community, and the education are top-notch, and I am very, very grateful to attend such a wonderful school. I want to take a minute to discuss the implications of enrollment caps and tuition increases, not only on my campus, but on the system as a whole. When Measure 5 passed in 1990, universities were in a similar situation as they are today. They were forced to make trade-offs between access and quality. As in 1990, today's students are faced with skyrocketing tuition and the possibility of enrollment caps to keep enrollment down. When tuition was increased dramatically and enrollment was capped in 1990, the impacts on students, universities, and the state were drastic. At OSU, enrollment went from 16,024 students in 1990 to 14,891 students in 1991. For the entire OUS system, enrollment dropped about 3,300 students from 90 to 91. And this was only the first year of cuts to this system. Enrollment dropped not only because of enrollment management plans to keep enrollment low, but also because of a $600 tuition increase that priced many students out of an education. It was not until the year 2000 that base enrollment, was at the same level that was in 1990. During 1990 to 2000, Oregon's population was increasing, and our college enrollment was lower than it was at the beginning of the decade. In 2003, a bachelor's degree is more important for success in today's economy than ever before. A student with a bachelor's degree has an average income of $46,276, while a student with a high school diploma has an average income of $28,807. Not only does the degree benefit the individual, but also through higher earnings, they will spend more in the economy and provide a greater return through taxes. Oregon can't afford to limit access as it did in the early 90s. By implementing enrollment management at the same time as increasing tuition, Oregon is limiting access to a very particular group of students. Current students that will be most affected by these policies come from lower to middle class income backgrounds, lower to middle income backgrounds, where an education is their opportunity to better provide for themselves and their families. The people that will be most affected by enrollment cuts are students that work through high school, student parents, people that get laid off from their jobs, or merely people just trying to better their skill set. These are the same students that will be priced out of an education because they can't afford the extra $300. The higher income students will get their applications in earlier and will be able to cover the increases in tuition. I know that you all are faced with very difficult decisions and times, but it is important that in 2003, Oregon does not repeat past mistakes. We limited access to thousands of students in the 90s because of enrollment cuts and tuition increases, and students in Oregon as a whole have left the impact of those have felt the impact of those decisions. Please fund the Oregon University system at a level where the system can minimize the cuts in enrollment. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Morning, Chair Morgan, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Greg Magnus. I'm a student at Western Oregon University, as well as the president of the Associated Students of Western Oregon University. When the Oregon University system addressed Senate Bill 437, they referred to the student's stance on keeping tuition in the hands of the legislature. Although the Oregon University system has not focused on having final authority over the tuition, over tuition in their budget process, it is something they will be asking for in the future, and we want to make our position clear. When Oregon created public colleges and universities, lawmakers recognized not only the importance of higher learning, but also the state's vested interest in supporting and overseeing an accessible public education system. Currently, the legislature is an integral part of a check-and-balance system that ensures that tuition is determined fairly and effectively. After hearing input from all affected parties, the legislature sets limits on tuition levels. If universities need to raise tuition over the limits set during the during the biennium, they simply must return to the legislature for approval. Legislative oversight of tuition provides a vital avenue for constituent involvement in tuition decisions. Students deserve the opportunity to discuss tuition with their elected officials and have an influential part of the tuition setting process. If total tuition setting authority was transferred to the State Board of Higher Education or the individual campuses, the boards could choose to include students in the decision or not. The state board is not elected, so there is no accountability, and they do not share the same relationship that the legislature does with its constituents. As representatives elected to act in the interest of the state, we believe that legislators provide essential input on decisions about education in Oregon. Legislators have the responsibility and the opportunity to ensure that our public university systems is in line with the state's goals and objectives. The Oregon Student Association has been a part of the tuition discussion at the legislative level for the past 28 years, and the system has worked well. There have been tuition increases and tuition freezes, but at every step of the way, students were involved. We are not proposing a tuition freeze. We just want to ensure that the legislature has the final say in how much tuition will increase. The State Board of Higher Education still has the authority to set tuition. It just has to be approved by the legislature. And having the final check seems like a logical and an important step. Demand for higher education is at an all-time high, as a post-secondary degree is becoming essential for success more and more students are trying to make college a reality. The demand will exist, but who is able to fill the demand will change. Middle and upper income students will be able to fill Oregon's universities. Their market price is much higher than students from a low-income background. Low-income students are the most price-sensitive, and the neediest students will be the first to be priced out of a higher education. Oregon does not have a strong enough need-based grant system to provide for these low-income students, and until we do, it is critical we protect them by trying to keep tuition increases as low as possible. I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Chair Morgan, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rachel Pilliad, board chair of the Oregon Student Association and president of the Associated Students at the University of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. OSA represents students at the seven campuses of the Oregon University System, Oregon Health and Sciences University, and Lane Community College, representing over 75,000 students in post-secondary education across Oregon. In its 28-year history, OSA has always advocated for access to high-quality post-secondary education. We believe Oregon is now, perhaps more than any other time in those 28 years, at risk of failing to provide either. Having said that, we recognize the extreme difficulty you face in trying to piece together a workable state budget as Oregon's weak economy continues to worsen with no sign of quick recovery. But minimizing the erosion of quality and access will pay off in the future as educated workers earn more and return more to the state in income taxes, on which our general fund has become almost totally dependent. The cuts we face today may be even worse than those made after the passage of 1990's Measure 5. Then, repeated tuition increases, program cuts, and enrollment caps pushed nearly 12,000 students out of public higher education. Our concern then, as now, is that such a situation pushes the most economically vulnerable students out of a higher education altogether, while our best and brightest students are lured to other states where they often stay. The recent F grade for access to public higher education in Oregon, given in the Measuring Up 2004 report by the Center for Public Policy and Higher Education, illustrates the seriousness of our access crisis and stark reality our students face as they make decisions over where to attend college. Currently, students pay about 50% of the cost of higher education, with general fund dollars making up the rest. OSA strongly supports OUS's goal of maintaining this balance, which still represents a gradual increase in the student contribution over time. We further support OUS's efforts to find innovative ways to make the best of this difficult situation by exploring new approaches to managing the system of higher education. We fully support OUS in its efforts to attain a funding level that would keep tuition increases reasonable and minimize enrollment caps, an equally serious threat to access. We also support their efforts to protect excellence within Oregon's seven universities so we don't lose our best faculty to better funded institutions. While OSA and OUS have a strong cooperative relationship and share the same fundamental vision for higher education, there are a few areas where we must respectfully disagree with the system. The first issue is the size of the institution, the size of the tuition increases, rather, the system is seeking. Making existing surcharges permanent with additional increases will mean tuition hikes of nearly 30% for students at some OUS campuses. While we're seeing tuition increases across the country, Oregon's anemic state-based financial aid, coupled with tuition that is already highest in the West, will further entrench our near-bottom ranking for access nationwide. We are also very concerned about the system's efforts to take authority over tuition away from elected representatives in the legislature. We believe the best way to ensure responsiveness to the public on this issue is to keep the authority with this body. While appointed boards or administrators may have the best of intentions, they simply are not accountable to the public in the same way legislators have proven to be. We believe this lessening of accountability would inevitably lead to even higher tuition increases in the future. Like most groups who rely on general fund dollars, students see a bleak outlook for the foreseeable future.
30 seconds.
Sure. With no new revenue, we face profound degradation to the quality of the institutions, which, in turn, means the degrees we've worked so hard for have even less value. And with no new revenue, the system feels it must turn to students already burdened by the high cost of higher education to maintain a degree of quality. This leaves higher education with a kind of Sophie's choice for access. Raise the cost beyond what the neediest students can reach, or cap enrollment, keeping students out who would have otherwise been admitted. Both choices carry serious negative long-term consequences.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Chair calls John Brosi, David Johnson, and Jeff Siegitz. And next up is Paulette Pyle, Greg Addington, and Gary Bishu. Mr. Brosi.
Chairman Morgan and members of the committee, my name is John Brosi. I'm a land use planning consultant. I've been in this profession in Oregon since 1973, and I've owned my own business for 14 years of that time. private sector since 1979. I graduated from Portland State with 2 degrees in 1973, and I'm here to support the OUS budget in general, but Portland State University in particular. University I'm extremely proud to be associated with and continue to be associated with. I grew up in a big family in the Tualatin area, a large enough family that I knew that I was going to, if I was going to go to college, I was going to pay for the whole thing myself. That was just a given. I'm proud to say that I did do that. And like one of the earlier speakers that you had, an hour and a half ago or so, I started at Portland State with the intention of transferring. But after 1 year there, I fell in love with the programs that I was in and stayed for all 4 years and had a wonderful experience. I hope that with the budget situation that you all are facing, we all are facing, and you being in the legislature here on the hot seat, doesn't become an issue where one university is pitted against another. That would be extremely unfortunate and extremely short-sighted on the part of the legislature. I do strongly support the current funding system where the state funding follows the student. Portland State is Oregon's largest state university. Is, I think, thriving in that system and is a much better academic institution at 22,000 students than it was when I was going to school there, even though I had a great time and learned a considerable amount of things, obviously. I'm here partly to relate a personal current experience. I'm fortunate to have a very successful daughter who's a junior at South Salem High School. She is a National Merit Scholar candidate. She's an International Baccalaureate candidate. And she, as far as music goes, she's beyond all the Oregon Music Teachers Association. She's achieved and gone beyond all the Oregon Music Teachers Association levels in piano. She plays violin for two orchestras at South High. And by the way, they just finished first in district. We had a very busy weekend. And she then, on Sunday, she played a piano for a musical that the kids put on in church. I'd love her to find a university somewhere in Oregon. She's looking into the honors program at Portland State and other universities in Oregon, as well as private universities. Her mom went to Reed College. Besides other things, she wants a big academic challenge in her university. And at this point, I don't think the state can hold her.
30 seconds.
Thank you. And that's really a very unfortunate situation when you think about it. Like a previous speaker, we're looking at a situation where the best and the brightest are not allowed to go to school in the state of Oregon. And that's extremely unfortunate and not good for the long-term situation of the economy of the state. And I appreciate the situation you're in, but please consider the OUS system and livability of the entire state. Thank you
very much. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you. My name is David Johnson. I'm a professor of history at Portland State University, now in my 23rd year teaching there. I'm also currently chair of President Bernstein's Campus Committee on Budget Priorities for the next biennium. However, I must state that I'm speaking for myself in my comments. I'm also the parent of two boys, one who is graduating senior at Lincoln High School in Portland, an international baccalaureate student going off to college, and I share Mr. Brosi's concerns about that decision, and another son beginning high school in Portland, and as such have been very actively involved in the public school funding situation that has followed in the last 10 or so years from the passage of Measure 5. I'm keenly aware, that is to say, of the challenge that confronts the legislature this year. I've not only experienced the recession of 2002-2003, but also the early 1990s and also the early 1980s when I was a young professor at Portland State. Thus, I'm not here to ask you for more money, but to present some thoughts that have to do, from my perspective as a longtime faculty member and chair of this Budget Priorities Committee, having to do with efficiency as it relates to campus autonomy, which I know is a matter under discussion throughout the state. The committee that I chair made up of faculty, students, and staff, was appointed by the president to advise, first of all, in dealing with the current challenge in facing the decline in the state appropriation to Portland State University in the next biennium. Secondly, the president asked us to discuss and examine and propose ways to maintain Portland State University's growth, which has really, the university has blossomed, I think, in the last 6 or 7 years. Its growth in terms of the number of students that we serve, and also the growth which is related to the growth in enrollment in the stature of Portland State as a university known for its educational programs and for its scholarship, not in the region and across the United States. Later this month, this committee will hold hearings at the university on a number of ideas and proposals that we are currently discussing among ourselves. And the criteria that we have used throughout our proceedings, I've submitted a set of these for your consideration, have above all to do with maintaining the growth of Portland State University, growth in its enrollment, both in-state students and also out-of-state students, drawing the best and the brightest to Oregon, and the growth in our stature. Also, growing links between the university and the community with other state and other educational and research programs. The Budget and Priorities Committee is also preparing a white paper discussing potential structural changes having to do with the question of efficiency and autonomy. And it's on this point that I want to take this opportunity to express what is my personal conviction, but I think it is rather widely shared, that the students at Portland State University and arguably at other state institutions, we best serve by the legislature seriously considering greater financial and administrative autonomy to the state universities, particularly Portland State University. I urge the legislature to consider seriously the broadest range of measures in this regard. For example, I hope the legislature will not restrict access to Oregonians who want to pursue a college education at Portland State University. Portland State University is an engine of social and economic mobility. I have witnessed this hundreds and hundreds of times in my 20-plus years at Portland State University. It is this what has made my teaching career enormously fulfilling. And
Mr.
this is
Johnson, 30 yes, seconds.
Okay. Secondly, I hope the university will now consider allowing, for example, the university to offer its own benefit programs. Money saved will go to the classroom, to our students. I hope the legislature will allow the university to consider allowing the university to be free of various state rules, for example, allowing the university to retain interest earnings. This is, after all, earnings on student money. I hope the legislature will allow the university to consider allowing the university to issue capital bonds. I even hope that you will consider allowing Portland State University to establish its own independent governing board with a specific focus on the growth, efficiency, excellence of the institution. This is a time of crisis. I know my time is up, but I think it is an opportunity also to consider new ways of providing higher education in the state of Oregon, and particularly I think Portland State University is poised to accept this challenge for the benefit of the students and the state. Thank you very much.
Well, is this your testimony?
No, that is, additional material. That's the criteria that my committee has developed in terms of addressing, making recommendations to the president of Portland State about the current budget situation.
Would you consider allowing us to receive your testimony in written form to have copies of it distributed to the committee members?
I'd be happy to do that. I would have to sit down and compose a written statement from my notes if that would be acceptable.
If you would do that, I would much appreciate you getting that into the Legislative Fiscal Office so that we could have it distributed to the members.
Okay, I'd be happy.
Your comments are very thoughtful.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I thank you for the invitation of speaking to you this morning on a nice, wonderful morning that it is. I'm speaking to you from a couple of perspectives. Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot to say my name. My name is Jeff Seacakes. I I'm speaking to you from a couple of perspectives. Although I have not been the benefit of an OUS education, I have a family and three sons who are, one of them is in the system and two more shortly coming up behind him. I'm speaking from that position, and as also as a, I am the chief spokesperson for the union's higher education bargaining team that's currently seeking a new contract with OUS management. The state support for higher education has been on a downward path since the passage of Measure 5 back in 1990. There was a glimmer of hope in the 1999 legislative session when we saw the first real increase in state support in quite a few years. At the end of the 2001 session and after five special sessions of the legislature, it seems we're back into that downward spiral once again. My 20-year-old son, who is a recipient of a major scholarship and is a sophomore at Oregon State University, was unable to pay for his books this spring due to the tuition surcharges imposed on students during the fall and winter terms of this current year. Yes, his parents were able to come up with the funds for his books, but I wonder how many parents of students were not able to come up with funds to pay for books for their students. These surcharges, although the OUS was in an unattainable position of trying to maintain programs for students that were already signed up for programs that were already in place, had, because of a lessening support of state support, had to implement these surcharges on students. As you heard from my good friend Bart Lewis and John Saylor earlier today, classified staff at all the Oregon University systems are doing much more with less. From where I stand, diminishing state resources can probably not be continued from within OUS without major programmatic adjustments, even hearing rumors of closing of some schools. I know they're only rumors, at least I hope they are. I know you realize that cutting programs is not just some lines on a spreadsheet, but loss of programs means loss of students. If programs are lost, where will those students go? My fear is that many of them will leave Oregon and not come back. We've seen that scenario play out in 1990 after the passage of Measure 5. In closing, I urge you to fund the university system at a level that minimizes tuition and fee increases, that guarantees access to young Oregonians, and maintains the public services that the Oregon University system represents. It's my opinion that Oregon's economic future is at stake. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I call Paulette Pyle, Greg Addington, and Barry Bashu, and on deck is Glenn Stonebrink. Good morning.
Good morning.
Ms. Pyle.
Good morning, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Paulette Pyle, and I'm grassroots director for Oregonians for Food and Shelter. And this morning, I've been asked to present the Oregon Wheat Growers testimony, but want to add that I've worked for the last two biennials to really enhance the research projects at Oregon State, and want to everyone to keep in mind that I'm still in that position, although I'm presenting the Wheat Growers presentation this morning. The Oregon Wheat Growers League, one of the first trade associations in the state, was created in 1926 by a small group of wheat producers who were determined to unify the voice of the industry to weigh in on legislative issues of concerns at both the state and federal levels, and to educate all producers about industry issues. In the early 1940s, the leadership of the wheat industry once again rallied together to establish the first wheat commission in the United States. It was their vision that all producers should contribute through a checkoff program to fund research, foreign market development, and education. Since that time, the wheat producers of Oregon have contributed every year to the research programs of Oregon State University. In fact, since 1996, the Oregon wheat producers have contributed over $2.2 million to research, with an annual average exceeding $370,000. I'm going to let you read some of this on your own. She just wanted me to highlight and make some very pointed points out of her testimony. In the 1999 legislative session, the Oregon wheat producers actively sought a public investment in agricultural research and extension. Prior to that time, the state had been disinvesting in agricultural research and extension. Yet these two programs are vital to economic prosperity and growth, particularly in the rural parts of our state. For farmers, the cost of inputs and regulations continually rise, but commodity prices remain flat. Therefore, our only salvation is an increased productivity through research. And she wanted to make the point that agricultural research generates impressive returns to the state in a variety of ways. As the key to improving agricultural productivity, continuing investment in research leads to healthy rural economies and stable employment for farmers, farm workers, agribusiness, and entire county economies in rural Oregon. These private sector jobs generate income for the state. If rural economic health is lost, no amount of increased tourism can replace its contribution to the statewide economy. State policy should favor the maintenance and creation of private sector jobs, which generate income and revenue to the state, as opposed to public sector creation, which consumes state resources. The public also has a non-economic interest in agricultural research. It's important to make note that much of agricultural research is dedicated to solving environmental challenges in farming, which returns positive environmental benefits to the public that are difficult to measure. Pardon me?
30 seconds.
Okay. To measure, but nonetheless present and real. Achievements made in conservation farming to reduce erosion and runoff would not have been possible without research to develop the technology and extension to transfer and adapt it for producers. The rest of the stuff that she has here, I hadn't intended on presenting, Madam Chair. Just it gives you a foundation for what the Wheat Commission actually contributes to their well-being in the area of research and marketing and education. So with that, I'll close, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Addington.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Greg Addington. I'm Associate Director of Governmental Affairs for the Oregon Farm Bureau. And I'll be very brief. We just wanted to be here to offer our support for the statewide research and extension programs. We have members involved in virtually every commodity grown in this state, and I would say as close as a group of our size can be to being unanimous, they are in their support and their belief that the research and extension programs are the backbone of what we do. Both economically and environmentally, they play a huge role in our success as an industry. With me is our state president, Barry Beshu, and I'll let him speak further as a stakeholder and head of our organization.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Beshu.
Thank you, Representative Morgan, members of the committee. My name is Barry Beshu. I'm a farmer near Gresham, Oregon, raise a diversity of crops, and in fact, my wife does most of the work now and does it much better than I ever could. Firstly, Oregon Farm Bureau has a vested interest in a strong agricultural economy, and we believe that interest is shared by the community as a whole and the state as a whole. And in a year of budget crisis, the ag economy needs to continue to be recognized as a valuable part of that state's economy. We also have a vested interest in a very strong land-grant university system and a strong and healthy and viable College of Ag Sciences. Its research and extension programs are a critical component of that strength. Good research is long-term and requires long-term support. We are supportive of the College of Ag Sciences budget for research and extension as proposed by the governor, and we would hope that you as leaders of our state's budget system would take that into account. With regard to extension, I would be fooling myself if I thought that I could any more appropriately address the issue than the four young women who faced you earlier. I think they are tremendous examples of the success of 4-H programs, and it exemplifies the quality of youth and leadership that develop from those programs. I would hope that you would consider these issues very carefully and with a look to the future that these children offer us. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Glenn Stonebrink.
Good morning. For the record, Glenn Stonebrink with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, and today also speaking for the Oregon Hay and Forage Association. We're here in strong support of the OSU extension and research programs. We see these as essential services to not necessarily to enhance and promote our industry, although that'd be nice if we had the funds, but actually to maintain and sustain our industry through good science and research. The outreach and education programs we feel is a must to provide the necessary information concerning compliance, oftentimes through such things as water quality. and also across the state in dealing with noxious weeds, goose predation, et cetera. We realize that the budget concerns and that you and we must face, and we've brought forth in other parts of legislation cuts that will continue to be a part of any, and we will be a part of any other necessary cuts. Hopefully you can support the governor's budget, realizing that the major cuts have already been taken in 2002, and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. I have no more people signed up to testify, which is very fortunate because we're out of time. So I will close the public hearing on House Bill 5021, and we will begin deliberations tomorrow on public hearings on the community college workforce development budgets. With that, I will close the meeting, and we'll reconvene at 8:30 tomorrow morning.